Thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to be with you today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Very good, very good. I'd love to start with something that's a bit more expansive and speaking a bit more to your journey. Given that medicine is such a wide open field, what was your rationale for choosing neuroscience as your particular path?
Well, it would be wonderful to say that each of our paths were crystal clear to us throughout our lives, but as you well know, at different points in your life, you're given choices. And it actually, on some level, reflects back on this event that occurred in this magic shop. And to give you a little bit more background on that story, I was 13 at the time. I had grown up in a family in which my father was an alcoholic and my mother was an invalid. We were on public assistance. In that type of an environment, and neither of my parents had gone to college, in that type of an environment, especially when day after day you don't see change, at least in a positive direction, and I'm not trying to imply that I suffered in the sense of any physical or sexual abuse, but that being said, it wasn't an ideal situation. So as a child, oftentimes, one, you somehow think you're responsible for being in a situation like that, and number two, when you don't appear to have many options, it can be depressing, and you can feel you're in a hopeless situation. And I think it's even more difficult if you have insight and you're intelligent, so you think about these things. So I had begun to make probably some negative choices in terms of behavior. And walking into that magic shop and this interaction with this woman, who in fact she was not the owner of the magic shop, she was actually the owner's mother, and she knew nothing about magic as we traditionally think. But as you pointed out, after a very brief conversation, she said, "I like you, and I think I can do something that can change your life." And that led to this conversation. And so, really, if you will, that was obviously a transformative experience, but in fact, it gave me my first insight into this idea of neuroplasticity and changing your brain. And this idea had stayed with me, and I had always wanted to be a physician. And in fact, because of another serendipitous interaction with a family practice doctor who served as an inspiration to me. And then I just decided to take it to its next level. And in fact, I became a neurosurgeon. And then because of the interest in understanding, one, why people who are in positions of power or influence look at individuals who are suffering and do nothing, and then you see this paradox of people who have suffered greatly and have little but give everything. This stuck with me, and as a result, as I became to be in a position where I could actually be active in looking at this is what ultimately led me to founding the center at Stanford and doing the work that we do, and on multiple levels, trying to understand how our brain works, and in fact, realizing that one of its greatest attributes is caring for others and how important it is in regard to our own mental and physical health. And by doing so, not only are we benefiting others, but in some ways, very selfishly, we're greatly benefiting ourselves.
That's wonderful. I was also hoping, Doctor, that you would expand on the story of the woman in the magic shop. I was just so entranced with that. It really was transformative and very inspirational. Let me ask you, Western medicine is a very high power, high stakes, intellectual profession. So the subject of compassion and altruism is usually considered something very soft, very Eastern, spiritual. I'm wondering, was it a hard sell to your colleagues, your university administrators, and potential funders. I know that the Dalai Lama is an ardent financial supporter, but did you experience any roadblocks or pushback trying to get the center established?
None whatsoever. It was embraced by everyone. You know, it is sort of fascinating, though, isn't it, that somehow, without too much difficulty, when someone creates a proposition of fear, we are able to, as an example, spend $30 million on a missile to kill people with minimal decision making. Yet on something that on a very deep, profound level results in a much, much better and sustainable outcome, we have difficulty embracing this and finding the funding for it. But to directly answer your question, the trajectory of my life and career by no means have been a straight path, nor traditional. And I'll give you a couple examples which will lead to the answer to your question. And remember, I'm at Stanford University, which I think nominally would be considered one of the best universities in the world. And I'm a professor of neurosurgery, which, as you pointed out, you talk about high-powered medicine. That's certainly considered a fairly high-powered profession. But going back a little bit, I will tell you, when I started college, my parents had not gone to college. I had no experience in this environment. And as a result of my parental situation, and in some ways I was actually being a parent, I was the one responsible and kept things together within our family, I left the university on multiple occasions. And while I had told people I was going to be a physician and wanted to, many of my friends or acquaintances who had a much more traditional path, stable family, parents who had gone to college, in fact, many were doctors, you know, they had a path in which they had a high academic achievement. When it came for me to apply to college, I actually had a 2.53 GPA, when the average GPA for acceptance into medical school was around 3.7 or so. And I was told repeatedly that I would never go to medical school, and that I might as well just forget it. Now, there's a little longer story involved, which I'm not sure if we really have time for in that regard, but I will tell you, ultimately, I was accepted to medical school, and not only accepted with that GPA, but in fact, at the time of my acceptance, I didn't even have a degree. So going to medical school in that context is fairly unusual. And in fact, to take another step, when I went to apply for residency, and neurosurgery is a very competitive residency, the residency that I applied for actually had a 3-year wait. And I was told, well, we love you, but it's going to be at least 3 years before we can accept you. We can accept you provisionally and anticipate you'll be in 3 years, but you have to do something else, either research or something during that period of time. And magically, notice how I use that term, the position opened up. The person who was supposed to be in that position had some events occur in his life where he dropped out, if you will, or actually a situation occurred where he would not be in the residency. And they said, well, everyone else was already doing things, and so your application suddenly come to the top and we accept you. So, if you will, since this transformative experience, it seems as though things have continued to line up, but again, not in the traditional way. So, as part of my journey, I have also been a fairly successful entrepreneur and ended up donating a significant amount of monies to Stanford and, in fact, endowed a chair there. I had had an entrepreneurial activity, if you will, where I took over a failing medical device company that a friend of mine developed and had believed so much in the technology that I made immense personal, financial, and professional sacrifices to save this company. And ultimately, that company went public in 2007 with a valuation of $1.2 billion. And I ended up giving all of the money I made from that to charity. And that actually endowed a chair at Stanford and actually my medical school that had accepted me, and also allowed me to fund some research and do some other projects. So when I ended up at Stanford, I started just getting a small group of people together to just explore my interest in the neuroscience of compassion. And there were certainly very few people had any interest in that at Stanford. And in fact, honestly, one of the scientists said, well, Dodie kept coming back and he kept tugging at me and he wouldn't leave me alone. So I finally agreed to do the stuff with him. And in fact, what's interesting is that's really changed the course of his professional life. But anyway, that led to some interesting science. And then I said, boy, it'd be incredible to get the Dalai Lama to come to Stanford to talk about compassion. And again, through a fortuitous interaction, I ended up meeting with His Holiness. And really, imagine the very first meeting with this incredible human being. I told him what I was interested in doing, what I believed in, and how hopeful I was that this research could lead somewhere. And not only did he immediately agree to come to Stanford, but at the end of our conversation, he had an animated dialogue with his translator, who subsequently has become a dear friend of mine. But at the end of that animated conversation, His Holiness, of course, speaks perfect English, but they were conversing in Tibetan. His translator said, Jim, His Holiness so believes in this path you're on that he wants to make a personal contribution, which ended up being the largest contribution made by him to a non-Tibetan cause. So can you imagine, after one meeting with this man, to have him not only agree to do what you wanted, but now he's actually giving you money? And then this led then to two individuals immediately making very significant donations. And then we're in a dilemma, because now I go back to my department, you know, in the university at Stanford, and the head of the Neuroscience Institute's a good friend of mine. And so I say, geez, now you've got this money. There's no formal center at all here. And you have no domain experience. Geez, what are we going to do? So this led to a meeting with the chairman of my department, the head of the Neuroscience Institute, the dean of the medical school, and basically, again, this issue of, Jim, you're a neurosurgeon. You know, you're talking about a center, but you don't have any research expertise in this area. In some ways, this is sort of ludicrous. And then there's a conversation with these individuals. And basically, my department chairman and the head of neuroscience said, you know, we know Jim. We've had experience with him. We know his background and abilities. We will stand behind this. And basically, the dean said, well, then we're going to create a center here at Stanford, and Jim will be the director. And that's how it happened.
Wow.
Oh, my. Thank you so much for sharing that, Dr. Dodie. It's intriguing to hear you share about the interconnection between your experiences as a medical doctor and how you're bringing in the Dalai Lama into the conversation. I'd love to hear your reflections on the overlap between the medical side of what it is that you're working on now and the more, I hesitate to use the word religious, but the aspects that are more on the intangible side. How are you melding those two?
Well, let me clarify two issues. One is the center that's been established here is a science center. It is purely secular, and it has no affiliation with any particular religion. And specifically, I say this in regard to Buddhism. The thing I will tell you is I am not a Buddhist. If you will, I don't have a dog in this fight, perhaps. what I will tell you is that there, this intersection of medicine and, if you will, I'll use maybe the term spirituality, we know that from an evolutionary perspective, the science clearly demonstrates that as species have become more complex, I won't say of a higher order, but let's say from the evolution of insects to man, we clearly have evidence that caring and nurturing have and continue to be very important components and for our for a species to survive, and probably no more importance than within the human species. And while people will quote Darwin and make statements such as, well, you know, it's the most ruthless who actually survive. Number one, he did not really say that. And what he did say was it's the kindest, if you will, that survive. And I think science has shown, not only in higher mammalian species, but I think we also see within man that while that type of behavior will result in short-term gain, for long-term survival and flourishing, there has to be compassion and caring. So we know that certainly within the medical profession and within essentially all religions, the fundamental core is the recognition of suffering and intervention and relief of suffering. I think what has happened with religion oftentimes is there is a distortion of that message, which unfortunately is a manifestation of egos of individuals and not the message per se. If you strip off, if you will, the baggage that has been attached, if you, as an example, in religion, and just remain with that core, then there wouldn't be a whole lot of problems in the world. So, and again, as a physician, I can tell you that, and I actually, and it was a great honor, I actually gave a talk at my medical school in something called the White Coat Ceremony, which is to inspire the young doctors coming in. But one of the things I said was that, you know, while science and technology offer great hope to cure various ills that we have, that the cures that I have seen in my own experience as a physician are just as equally associated with the art of medicine. And what I will tell you is that there is no science, there is no technology that is going to hold and comfort a child who has cried or in pain. All the technology and science in the world is not going to hold the hand and comfort a person who is dying, to give them comfort through this transition period. It is human touch, it is human connection that is equally, if not more, powerful than all the science and technology in the world.
That's just wonderful to hear. It's, in fact, you already answered another question I was going to ask you, so thank you very much for that very thorough explanation. I'm going back to a blog post you had up, I think it was back in June, and you wrote of an epidemic of loneliness, depression, and anxiety in the U.S. I'd be interested to know what you think other countries or cultures are doing differently that makes them more emotionally and psychologically whole.
Well, I would tell you that, unfortunately, many of those cultures that you're describing are actually not in the first world. They're in the third world. And the reason that is because in those cultures, the survival of the family unit, if you will, or the group, is absolutely critical in regard to the behavior of those in that group. Because, you know, when your security is threatened, when you don't have enough food, when the weather is bad, if you will, everyone has to work together. And in fact, them not working together puts the family or the group at risk. Also, you recognize the importance of each person in that unit. And a couple of things. One is, when you're in a situation like that, everyone sees you for who you are. They know your strengths. They know your weaknesses. They know when you're not living up to your social responsibility, if you will, because it's blaringly obvious. But they also know that you, regardless, are an important part of that group. Therefore, they work with you and help you and mentor you. And you have elders who tell stories about, let's say, the survival of your family or your group or how important that is. And it inculcates with you within you this sense of how important you are as a human being, how important you are to the lives of others, and it gives you a sense of value and a sense of responsibility. What happens as you make this transition is that, as in the United States, how many people live with their parents? How many people live with their grandparents? Very, very few. And in fact, in our transient society, people are far distant from their families. And so you don't have this intergenerational family connection. Additionally, if you don't have a safe place, as an example, where you can sit there and say, you know, this is bothering me, or I failed here, and you don't have somebody who you trust where you feel you can make those statements and they still embrace you, what happens is, and I think this is true in so many situations, you carry this mask of invincibility where you're saying, you know, I'm good at my job, I know what I'm doing, I have my act together, you know, I don't have any problems. And there's this lack of showing your vulnerability because you think that's what's important for you to survive. But when you have a mask of invincibility or lack of access to your true feelings, then you don't connect with people at a deep, authentic level. You know, I know situations where people have been sitting in cubicles next to each other for years. And basically, very, very little is exchanged except, how are you today, da-da-da. There's no, and that person could be having cancer or have a loss of a loved one, and they never even know it. And so when you're shielding yourself from showing your vulnerability, you're separated from others, and you can't get that nurturing. And when you don't get that nurturing when you're in pain or that relief of that suffering, then you feel isolated and alone. And it's a horrible feeling because it creates stress within yourself. It makes you less productive, and it makes you, if you will, more self-absorbed about your own pain, where your eyes are not open to look at how wonderful the world is, and also to look at and say, oh, someone there is suffering, how can I help them? And that is the tragedy of our modern existence. You know, we have a land like the United States where we have, on some level, everything in regard to consumption. But on another deep spiritual level, we are starving. So, you know, you have everything, but you have nothing. And this is why so many people are desperately looking to have a sense of purpose in their life, to be part of something that's beyond themselves, and to give them meaning. And that meaning is not translated into a Prada purse or a Italian sports car. It is translated into authentically connecting with another person.
Wonderful. Dr. Doty, it sounds to me that what you're saying as an underlying message is, this is really about inner transformation at a societal level, not necessarily just practicing compassion per se, but to become compassionate and to have that kind of lead into a network effect. So I was wondering if you have reflections on how to seed this into society. Is there such a thing as a network effect for compassion?
Yes, and let me make a couple comments which will lead into, I think, a fairly specific answer. I give a talk called Transformation and Transcendence. And on some level, it relates, you know, there's this immense popularity within the Western community, especially in the United States, where we talk about mindfulness, which has been a technique which has been secularized and brought to the West to give people tools to be more focused, attentive, to have non-judgmental self-reflection and to be present, if you will. And all of that is wonderful. The problem sometimes with that, though, with some people, especially I would say type A people, is that they take that practice, and frankly, sometimes it doesn't, they forget the other component of that. You know, if you go back to its origin in Buddhist philosophy, the wings of this bird are wisdom and compassion through this meditative practice. If you don't have those aspects, or if you will, the wisdom and the insight, this incredible tool, while it allows you to change your brain, doesn't necessarily make you connect better to others. And in fact, in some type A people and others, it becomes just another tool for self-absorption and isolation. Okay. What, though, leads to transcendence, which is, and when we get back to this transformation mindfulness, this is an inward journey of an individual. Transcendence is fundamentally an outward journey that involves you connecting to others. It is a journey that at your deepest level makes you recognize the interconnectedness and the oneness of us all, and it puts you in a position where you have the ability to get the entire benefit of that oneness by helping another person. And when you're engaged in activities that help others, it also puts you in a position where it's not simply 1 + 1 = 2, it's 1 + 1 = infinity, where your participation leads to an exponential benefit to the world. And it's that connection where you feel that you are part of something beyond yourself, where you're connecting to something that at its deepest level satisfies this need within us, that is transcendence. And that is at the core of what all of us want in our lives to give us purpose.
That's great. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. Let me ask you this question next. Taking a somewhat different turn, perhaps, if one might call it the dark side of compassion, there is a phenomenon known as compassion burnout. There are many caregivers who experience it, people in high trauma professions. What is your understanding of it from a neurological point of view, and what's the healing process?
Well, I think it's not so much that people use the term compassion fatigue, but in some ways it's a excess of empathy, I would say. Unfortunately, and this is very true in the medical profession, and in fact it is one of the reasons we see physicians who are brusque, they don't engage with patients, because sometimes the cost is such that when they're completely connected, they falsely believe that that connection then will get them too involved and they'll be overwhelmed with emotion and as a result can't handle it. I mean, the reality in the world is that there is effectively unlimited suffering. And if you put yourself in a position where you're taking on everyone's suffering, and remember, if we, I can just use some definitions, empathy is putting yourself in another's shoes, if you will. This is this concept of mirror neurons, where you're taking on the experience or the suffering or the pain or the emotion of another person. And in the context of what we're talking about, suffering specifically, this can be incredibly painful. And if you don't have tools to ameliorate that pain or take it to its next step, which is, I recognize this person is suffering, I want to relieve that suffering, I'm going to engage in trying to relieve that suffering, and you get stuck in the taking on the suffering aspect of it, it can be very destructive and overwhelming to one's resources. The thing that individuals have to learn to prevent this is to develop boundaries. And this, and when I say boundaries, these are boundaries of saying, here is what I can do in this situation, and I'm going to do it. And I recognize that I am only human, and I can only do so much, and that is okay. When you are able to set realistic boundaries and not feel that by not doing more, you're somehow failing or you beat yourself up, and this is this idea of self-compassion, then you can effectively engage. But if at every instance you go, oh, God, there's 20 people out there, there are 1,000 people out there, there's one of me, I can only take care of one or two or three or four, and, oh, my God, there are more coming in the door, you're suddenly overwhelmed. It overwhelms your processes, and this leads to depression, a sense of failure, a sense of being overwhelmed, which are obviously very destructive. And this, though, setting realistic boundaries doesn't mean you don't go into a patient's room, you don't talk to them, you don't express deep concern for them. You know, it's interesting because there's a confusion by some doctors that that's how you have to be, otherwise you're going to, quote, unquote, burn out. And that's not true at all. I will tell you in my own practice, number one, I spend time with patients. Two, I lean forward into when I talk to them because I'm interested in what they have to say. I will touch them. And each of those activities, right from the start, tells them you care. And look, the profession I'm in, we see a horrible tragedy. Now, that's not to say we don't see incredible, miraculous successes, but we see horrible tragedy. In fact, the interaction people have with us, either the patient or their family, can be the most important event that occurs in their life. How could you denigrate that by being disengaged? You know, it is a privilege to be a physician. And so when these bad things do happen, I put my arms around somebody, I hug them, I tell them how sorry I am, I sometimes cry with them. It doesn't make me less of a doctor. It doesn't make me, I haven't lost it yet. Well, maybe it depends on who you talk to. but my point is, it's to, though, say that all of that is okay, but it's not to get lost in it and feel like you're drowning in it. And one of the other aspects is, and you see this in His Holiness, who suffered terrible tragedy on a variety of levels, and other, in fact, spiritual leaders. Look at Desmond Tutu as an example. They've lived through horrible events, but what is the other thing that they maintain always? They maintain a perspective, and they maintain a sense of humor. And those are also critical to living a full life, too, because, you know, I talk about my part of the alphabet that actually I go through every day in terms of my own practice and to put me in a right position, and this is C, D, F, G, H, I, J, K. And if I can run through this very briefly with you and then get to the part I want to emphasize, C is compassion, and I consciously go through this alphabet every day, compassion. Recognizing that everyone is suffering on some level and that you are also suffering, and to be cognizant of that. D is dignity, recognizing the dignity of every human being. E is equanimity, recognizing that in our lives there are going to be highs in which we feel just utterly fantastic. There are going to be lows, which we just feel horrible and that we're worthless people. But the reality is, all of these are transient. And if you try to grab onto the highs, you're going to be disappointed. And if you attach to the lows and think that somehow that's always the way it's going to be, it just isn't. If you look at life and say, look, yes, I understand there are highs and lows. I'm not going to hook on to either. I'm going to keep the same disposition about the world as I go on, recognizing there are going to be these ups and downs. F is for forgiveness, recognizing that you're going to fail others and people are going to fail you. And if you hold on to anger and hostility, number one, you'll beat up yourself if you're the person who's failed someone or done an act against someone, and we're all human. The other is, if you don't forgive and you hold on to this, it locks you into this emotional freezer. It doesn't allow you to progress in your life. It's like you're drinking poison and somehow thinking that that's going to kill the other person, and it's only killing you. And then G is gratitude. You know, so many of us in Western society, what do? Instead of sitting there going, my God, just being in the United States or a country like the United States, I am better off than 99% of the people in the world. I am so blessed. The very common feeling is, look at so-and-so. His house is bigger than mine. He drives a better car than I do. He gets paid more than I do. My life is horrible. And because they're looking up. If you look down and you realize how high you are actually compared to the vast majority of the people in the world, you will be jumping for joy because you're so blessed. And then the other is H, which is humility. Again, and this is a problem in Western society. And I can tell you within, as a neurosurgeon, you know, for neurosurgeons to be humble, is that it takes years. But my point is that if you can maintain your humility and recognize in every interaction you have with a person, whether it's, as an example, in my job, whether it's an orderly who's cleaning up the beds or changing the bedpans or the linen, to whomever, we are all part of a family who are trying to do a task to help other people. And while I may have certain responsibilities, every person is critically important to that task, and we are equal. You know, this is the challenge. Instead of looking at an interaction with another human being as saying either I'm looking down at them and telling them what to do or I'm having to look up, if every interaction is at an equal eye level and that's how you view every person, number one, you recognize that you get value and insights from every human being. And no one is at a higher or lower level. We can all learn something. We can all give gifts to other people. We're all the same. And then I is integrity. Again, maintaining a sense of ethics and values in your interactions with others. J is justice, the concept of social justice, a responsibility as human beings to make sure that everyone has opportunity and that no one feels as if they are not cared for or that they don't have value. And then, of course, K is actually kindness, the implementation of compassion. And finally, lastly, love, which is the universal glue that connects us all.
Wow. That was amazing. Thank you so much, Dr.
Sure.
Doty, for sharing all this with us. And I'm sure our callers are eager to ask you questions as well. So what we are going to do is open the Q&A session. And if anyone has a question, just hit *6 and you will be put in the queue. Biju, while we wait, maybe you can ask your next question, you or Jan, anyone.
Sure. I'm still stunned from what we just heard. So beautiful, and so juxtaposed against what is a commonly held idea of what a doctor would share with the HMO system that we're a part of.
What is HMO?
Yeah, I know that those are the wrong letter. but I would love to have that tie into a question of what your vision is for what it is that you're working on. What is it that you'd like to see come about as a result of this research that you're doing on compassion and altruism?
Well, actually, let me tell you something that I think is very exciting, which actually answers that question. You know, I made this comment about transformation and connecting and caring for others. I'm actually working on a project right now called the World Compassion Festival, which is to bring young people to service to those threats to our species that we're going to see over the next 20 to 30 years, which are poverty, water, ecological destruction, global warming, issues of women's empowerment, nuclear weapons. And one of the things we know is that when young people are given the opportunity to help others, they rise to the task. And the other is that once someone sees the value and the benefit of caring for others, it becomes incorporated into their life. So the idea is, and I'm working, do you know Karen Armstrong? I'm sure you do. She's written a number of books about religion, and she's won the TED Prize in, for the Charter of Compassion. She's now got a Compassionate Cities program, and I'm planning a World Compassion Festival in a compassionate city. And as a build-up to this event in 2015, to have 100 compassionate cities and have a compassion festival in each of them related to volunteerism and service, and then on top of this have a concert with musical activists, and then on top of that have individuals who by their actions are defined as compassionate people at their absolute core. And in fact, I was just meeting with the Dalai Lama a few weeks ago, and he's embraced this whole concept and is going to participate in this. It's going to be his 80th birthday. It's going to be a phenomenal event. So this is to create a mem within our culture of compassion, which I believe has the ability to result in not only transformation, but transcendence, where this becomes so inculcated in our society that that's how we look at the world.
Thank you. Oh, hi, this is Bill. I've been interested in the exponential effects of collective consciousness for quite some time, so my ears perked up in a statement when you made a statement a few questions back about individuals, one plus one being much more than one. I wonder, could you say any more about that, or do you maybe have a reference?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not the only person who believes in that. If you ask me to show you the mathematical formula, I cannot. It's interesting, you know, there's this concept of quantum consciousness and the entanglement of all particles, which I don't think there's any question we are all entangled, but I'll tell you an interesting story. I was at an event that Deepak Chopra puts on, and Deepak had asked me to give a talk, and I was talking about compassion, but it turns out, and I probably should have investigated this further, the actual event, though, focused on quantum consciousness, and there were many particle physicists there, and Deepak actually never told me what I was when he wanted me to talk, and I kept asking him. And finally, at the end, he says, well, Jim, I just want you to close the event and summarize what was said here today. Now, imagine what that is like, since I know nothing about quantum mechanics, but here's what I said, and I think this is the only way I can answer your question, which is, I said, I know nothing about quantum mechanics. I know nothing about quantum physics and particle entanglement, but what I do know at a fundamental level is that we are all entangled, and that entanglement is love.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi, Dr. James. This is Ashish from New Jersey. Wonderful, wonderful talk. It was very engrossed. I had a couple of questions. One is related to an institution that's in Santa Cruz called HeartMath, which you may have heard of. They actually, I think I have a hypothesis that the heart actually talks to the brain, and they talk about a term called coherence, and they have a set of tools that, you know, designed for more the practical use where, you know, you can improve your performance if you do a certain set of exercises. But my first question was, you know, if you have, I've looked into that field of, you know, neurocardiology, and based on your scientific background, can you share more about, you know, whether you believe in that, you know, how much the heart talks to the brain, and what tools we can use to actually open up our heart, practical tools. And the second question was more about the concept of transcendence, which I thought was very fascinating. It was always had the perspective of transformation and never really thought of it the way you put it. So just extending on the first question is, you know, how can we practically move from transformation to transcendence given the constraints of our society in the U.S. as we've all kind of described and understood? Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's an excellent question. And yes, there's a company called HeartMath, and they are and have spent a great deal of time developing their technology. They're certainly not the only company that does that, although they're the only company that talks about this issue of coherence, which is a proprietary algorithm that they have incorporated within their technology. But that being said, let me sort of cut to the meat of the matter. There are two parts of our autonomic nervous system, which the brain controls, if you will, this part of our anatomy, which essentially spreads throughout our entire body, all of the organs, and particularly there is representation within the heart. And the two parts of the system are the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. We're all familiar with this concept of activation in the context of fear, where our sympathetic nervous system releases these hormones, and if we were in Africa on the savannah and we were had a threat to our lives, there would be epinephrine released and cortisol, and this would allow us to run fast and close down our other non-needed systems to get away from this threat. Conversely, the parasympathetic nervous system is one which allows us, our sphincters, if you will, to relax, our pupils to constrict, our attention to be focused on others, to be cooperative, to connect with others. It puts us in a relaxed state where we can actually listen and process. Okay? And there are many more aspects in the brain that are involved, but this is sort of a simple part of it. Our evolution, though, has not caught up with us in the context of how to control these two systems. And in our modern society, we're inundated with information, data, demands. The sympathetic system is engaged on a constant level far beyond what it should be and has huge deleterious effects in regard to health, both mental and physical. When you see the sympathetic nervous system chronically engaged, multiple things happen, but one is this leads to sudden cardiac death. In fact, when this system is out of whack, there's a very high incidence of sudden cardiac death. It leads to deleterious effects on not only the vessels in the heart and the heart itself, but also the peripheral blood vessels. It is associated with depression, anxiety. It is associated with other conditions, if you will, mind-body disconnects, chronic pain syndromes, headaches. And in fact, if you look at the long-term consequences of these type of activation of your sympathetic nervous system beyond what it should, longevity is dramatically affected. We know that mindfulness practice, compassion meditation practice, puts this system back into balance where there's more of a focus on the parasympathetic nervous system, which, again, you're not having the chronic release of these deleterious hormones, and you're in a position to be at your most productive and engaging and connecting and nurturing and have the ability to connect with others. So, and HeartMath has a technology, as do others, that allow you, if you will, use biofeedback tools to put your parasympathetic nervous system more in control than your sympathetic nervous system. So that's one aspect, and I'll tell you a very quick story. which actually is quite humorous, but gives you the insight into Eastern culture versus Western. When they first started studying meditation and and specifically compassion meditation 25 years ago or so, the scientists went to study Tibetan monks, and they had this EEG cap, which measures brain waves and has all these electrodes sticking out of it. And the scientists wanted to show the monks how it worked and what it looked like. So one of the scientists took this cap, which is very funny looking, and some of you may have seen these pictures in the past, and he put it on, and he said, "We're going to use this to study compassion." And they all started laughing. And he thought that they were laughing because it looked funny. And he asked one of the monks, and of course they speak Tibetan, and he had a translator ask him why they were all laughing. And because he assumed it was because of the appearance. And they said, "They're laughing because obviously you know nothing. Compassion is found in the heart, not in the brain." And in fact, I think that's very true. Getting back to the second part of your question really quick, this concept of transformation. You know, we can give names to all varieties of events or actions. For me, transcendence fulfills this yearning we have to connect with others on a deep level. So I use that term. Can people use transformation? Certainly. But that's how it connects with me and resonates with me when I use that terminology. But, you know, just to give you a quick comment about the power, though, of these types of transformation or transcendence to you, you know, if you can think of an event in your life where you were either suffering or wanted something very badly, and you had exhausted every resource to obtain that or relieve that suffering, what happens when that occurs? You feel as though you were isolated, you're unloved, that's you're undeserving, and it's a horrible position to be in. It's like, you know, the clouds have covered the sun, it's dark, and it's cold. And then you think about being in that position and having somebody come in, even doing a small act, which has either relieved that suffering or given you what you needed at your darkest moment when you thought there was no possibility of being saved, if you will, and how in a microsecond your worldview changed. The sun is suddenly shining, you're loved, you believe there's a God, you believe you have purpose, you believe that that there are those who love you and that all of this was meant to be. And then think for a second about when you have actually done that to another person and how even hours, months, years later, when you relive the experience of how you helped another and the look on that person's face and the power that you had when you did this and how you helped them, that feeling, and it's at a very deep level, I think hopefully all of us have experienced it not only once but multiple times, and you sit there and you just for a second think about those events, you suddenly say, this is what we're all about. This is why we're all here, this deep feeling of purpose. And I think that is this transcendence, and that is the manifestation of it, and it's one that each of us, no matter our position in life, no matter what is going on in our world, we have the ability every day to have even just saying thank you to somebody who isn't usually thanked, or recognizing that you need other people to survive in your world and you're thankful for it and you express it in your actions. You have the ability to have that experience every day and feel that every day.
Thank you, Dr. James. I'm feeling a lot of the alphabet G right now.
Well, you're welcome.
Hi, Dr. James, thank you so much. My quick question is, what is the difference between selflessness? I mean, not the difference, but what are your thoughts on selflessness and self-care? Because those two things I get very confused with those two things.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think it goes back to this issue of self-compassion and also burnout or compassion fatigue. I would put into this context, all of us have the gift of caring for others and the ability to care for others. But none of us can do that effectively if we don't care for ourselves. Because if we don't care for ourselves, there will be no one to care for others. So one of the most important things is to be kind to yourself. One of the problems in Western society is that we are put in a position where we always feel we're being compared to or competing with. And it's so easy to sit there and say, oh, I screwed up. You have this self-talk which puts yourself in a negative position. So one aspect is to acknowledge that you are a human being with all the positives and minuses of that, but also on a deep level to sit there and say, I am blessed, I have these abilities, I have this ability to connect with others, to care for others, and it will enrich my life, but I also have to give that same sense of unselfishness to myself. And one of the aspects of that is to be self-nourishing, to give yourself appropriate rest, to give yourself appropriate acknowledgement for actually your core goodness, and not feel that your goodness is defined by what others think of you, or that somehow your goodness has to be manifested by self-sacrifice at such a level it's potentially destructive. And I think it's gaining that insight where you sit there and say, again, back to this issue I talked about earlier, yes, there is suffering. Yes, I have the ability to intervene in many instances, but I am also a human being, and I suffer as well, and I need to nourish myself and give myself time to recover and heal. And I think that's a really critical insight. Because unfortunately what happens sometimes is that the drive that people have to, if you will, put themselves at risk is because they have this deep emptiness, and they think that by standing out there and putting them at risk in terms of caring for others or doing these incredible acts fills that emptiness. Can it do that? On some level, yes, but it cannot do that unless that vessel is already filled with a sense of who you are and your own goodness. It's the way it works, I believe, is once you recognize your own goodness and it's that potential, then it gives you the power and the tools to reach out to others. If that vessel starts out empty and you keep somehow thinking that by doing this and doing that, that's going to fill it, and you're expecting all these accolades from others, and that's what you think is the definition of me being good, it doesn't work. On a fundamental level, you have to have clear knowledge that your action is good. It's a moral compass. It's an integrity about who you are before you start that outward action. It's not sitting there saying, I feel empty, and geez, if I go and work at the soup kitchen, that fills me up. Yes, it can, but there has to be a fundamental aspect of this where you recognize your own goodness, because without that, you're running around trying to do acts which are not going to give you the sustenance that you need at a spiritual level.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Sri. I'm actually calling from Peru. I'm doing some global health work here. I'm on faculty at UCSF in the Department of Medicine. And I just wanted to ask you in terms of your opinion of who are kind of the most exciting researchers that are, or research projects that are going on in the field, and what are the directions that you see the field heading in. And if the NIH or other entities are starting to get in the mix of funding some of this work.
Sure. You know, the NIH is involved and puts this in the context of complementary medicine. Unfortunately, it also puts it mixed in with some things that I would say are on the very fringe of medicine, and that because there's public interest in this, interventions, if you will, that many already know are useless. Unfortunately, it's mixed in with things that, such as mindfulness practice and some of these contemplative practice or neuroplasticity or change of brain techniques. So that bothers me a little bit. But that being said, yes, there's a mechanism with NIH through something called NCAM, which does offer some funding. It is limited. The researchers who are doing incredible work in this field is, one is, of course, Richie Davidson at University of Wisconsin in Madison, who's really been a pioneer for the last 30 years in understanding the effects of mindfulness practice and Buddhist meditation and its effects on the brain, and has then transcended or is now doing a lot of work in the field of compassion. Another is Tanya Singer at the Max Planck Institute. Another, Stephanie Brown at, in Stony Brook in New York. And there are individuals, of course, at Stanford. We're doing some interesting things on looking at the effects of stress on and how compassion training can relieve that. The other thing we've actually just instituted is something called the Science of Compassion Summer Research Institute. We're bringing many of the major researchers in the world to act as instructors to a group of graduate and doctoral students to give them an overview of this, you know, exciting field. If you look at the number of articles that are being published on compassion, altruism, empathy, it is really now on an exponential growth because there's such immense interest, and now we have the scientific tools which show the impact in regard to decreasing stress, improving health, increasing longevity by these types of interventions and behaviors. One of the projects that I'm working on is the creation of a compassion gymnasium, where, like exercise, we create a customized compassion exercise program for you, and then use various tools to show you how your compassion is being strengthened and show you the health benefits of that so that you continue the exercise. So I think we're seeing throughout the world an immense interest in this, and also the results of that. Now, where will this go? I don't know for sure, but I think we're seeing a fundamental change and recognition in the importance of compassionate action, the recognition of all of our interconnectedness, and, you know, this concept of this butterfly effect whereby, you know, we don't live in isolation anymore. An action in one part of the world can have profound effect on a variety of levels with the rest of the world. And until we reach out to alleviate the suffering of all human beings and all sentient beings, ultimately, our species is doomed. So we're in a really transition point, and we're at a path where, unless we focus science and technology and our immense gifts as human beings on addressing this issue, these issues, we're going to be doomed. Now, I won't go into whether that's good or bad. I don't know, but I do know. Yeah. That as human beings, we do have this incredible gift. We have this incredible connectedness. And it would be wonderful if we, as a species, could live up to the potential that we've been given.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much. This is a pretty amazing work that you're doing. And it's definitely an honor to be on the call and hear physicians that are kind of exploring these areas, because I think a lot of times, you know, med students and residents, they are hungry for this, but they don't have too many leaders that are bringing it to the forefront of discussions on rounds or making it relevant to our practice.
Well, and you know, it's sad. In fact, I had the dean of a medical say to me, well, Jim, we can't teach compassion because the residents have so much other stuff on their schedule. I go, really? Oh, that's sad. So, but there are individuals who are very interested in this, and there are a wonderful number of amazing, caring, compassionate physicians. And I think many more wish to be more like that, but unfortunately the context of how they're forced to practice by the method of how medicine is given in this country limits that, sadly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sri, for joining the call. And for those who don't know Sri, we are very proud of Sri because he himself is a doctor at UCSF, and he goes a few months every year to some countries in Africa and dedicates his time and love for serving. So we're really delighted to have Sri and Dr. Doty on the call today. What a privilege. Thank you so much. Yes, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just wanting to thank all of you and your listeners for kindly having me. And for anyone who didn't have a chance to ask a question, please feel free to email me. You can find me at Stanford quite easily. And if any of you are in the area or wish to participate in our work, please let me know.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I'm sure a couple of people would like to send you an email. So thank you, everyone, for this wonderful call. And thank you, Jan and Virju, and everyone who supported it.